Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What mark did Ray Bradbury leave on American literature and culture? In a writing career that spanned eight decades, Bradbury published dozens of plays, screenplays, and TV scripts, hundreds of short stories, and dozens of full-length works of prose, including the watershed novel Fahrenheit 451, which is the book chosen for this month's Big Read Dallas campaign. You can learn more about that at bigreaddallas.org. In honor of the effort to restore reading to the center of American and community culture, we've invited Bradbury biographer Sam Weller to join us today. He is professor in the fiction department at Columbia College Chicago, and his books include The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. Sam, welcome to Think.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So people looking for a shorthand description of Bradbury typically call him a science fiction writer. How did he feel about that?
Oh, he looked at that as sort of a misnomer. I mean, he was proud of his science fictional creations. But, you know, he always sort of steered clear of labels over the course of his career, politically, religiously. He was sort of a mixture of different things. And so he didn't like labels placed on him as an artist either. And you know, when push came to shove, he would acquiesce and say that he was a fantasist, not really a science fiction writer. And the difference in his mind was science fiction was really, he called, the art of the possible. It was something that could come to be, whereas fantasy was imagined. So Fahrenheit 451, the book you mentioned at the top here, is certainly a work of science fiction. He looked at it as a possibility in our future, but he really didn't write that much traditional science fiction, and so it's an odd label. It's interesting that that's where he's placed in most bookstores when he didn't really consider himself a science fiction writer at all.
So, for example, a book like The Martian Chronicles, he was aware from the start that he was claiming things that were not physically possible and never would be.
Precisely. I mean, he laughed and said, you know, people, you know, the science fiction purists would nitpick it and say, well, there's people running around on the surface of Mars without helmets. You can't breathe on Mars. There's no atmosphere. And he said, well, it's because it's fantasy. It's not science fiction. It can't happen.
And I love his rejection of labels allowed him to try everything. And I mentioned some of the things he did, but he also worked on operas and musicals. He really just never thought to himself, I shouldn't do that. That's outside of my purview.
Boy, that's a hugely important point you're bringing up. You know, as a professor at an art school, it's what I try to instill in my students, is this sense of creative fearlessness. The guy just didn't look at boundaries at all, and he never went to college himself. He didn't have the money. His formal education ended at high school, and nonetheless, he just sort of dappled in whatever he wanted to pursue. I mean, he had this creative mantra that I used to lead my first book on him, The Bradbury Chronicles. I used this as the quote to begin the book, and I think it's the quote that he'll probably be remembered for. It's, jump off the cliff and build your wings on the way down. Hmm. It's a beautiful sort of leap of faith philosophy that he did. He wrote, as you said, he wrote screenplays, he wrote radio plays, he owned his own theater company, he did architectural designs for shopping plazas, he even designed the interiors of Spaceship Earth at Epcot Center for the Disney Company. I mean, he was just this juggernaut of productivity and creativity, and he had really no formal training in any of it.
What first drew you to him as a writer?
Well, boy, you know, I think he's to me, in my mind, the penultimate imaginative storyteller. So he has these fantastic ideas that are almost like Greek or Roman myths. Once they get into your mind, you almost can't forget them. They're so memorable and they're so imaginative. But the ideas themselves are articulated through this majestic, poetic, lyrical language. I mean, Bradbury's voice as a writer is instantly recognizable. You pick a book up and you read a sentence or two, and you know right away that it's Ray Bradbury. It's drenched in musicality and melancholy, and it's very visual. So I think it was two things. It was the beauty of the language. Even as a young adult reader, I was drawn to beautiful writing, and I think he paid attention to prose, which a lot of genre writers, you know, don't always do. He paid attention to the quality of the prose itself. So it was this amalgam of the attention to the writing itself alongside fantastically imaginative ideas that make him such a singular entity.
He seems to have held little or nothing back from you, and I wonder how long it took for you to feel comfortable asking him anything you wanted to know.
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I interviewed him for the first time in May of 2000, and we hit it off. It was a six-hour interview. I was doing a profile of him for the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine, and I stayed with him for an entire afternoon. And when that interview was over, he said, "This has been fantastic. I want you to come back and visit me again." And as a journalist, I knew full well you don't hear that very often. So I took him up on it and regularly flew from Chicago to Los Angeles. I live in Chicago and would go visit him, and we would have lunch and dinner and just reminisce, talk about his life. And he knew I was fascinated and curious. And I would say, to your point, I think after about a year of visits every other month, he started to really connect with me in a big way and felt very open to allowing me to ask anything. I mean, I think this establishment of trust is imperative. When you're going to spend this much time and chronicle someone's life like this, you have to have that established completely. And so, I think maybe 9 months, all doors were open at that point, and I could really ask him anything. And I think, he realized that I could ask him very delicate questions, and I was always very sensitive to the way I phrased them. I wasn't interrogating him. I wasn't ever trying to put him on the spot. I was trying to ask them delicately with sensitivity, but also with great interest, and he respected that.
It seems like, Sam, that at that point in his life, he felt an obligation, am I right here, to share his life with the society he was ultimately going to leave behind soon?
That's a great point. I met him when he had just turned 80. He had just suffered a pretty traumatic stroke, and he was going through rehabilitation and fighting his way back and still writing and getting out of the house and trying to recover his motor skills physically. And I met him at a very delicate point in his life. And after my story in the Chicago Tribune had run, he read it and called me late one night and said, "I read your profile and you're a beautiful writer." And, to get that validation from a great American writer was such a fantastic, unexpected reward. And I said, "Well, I'm going to keep continuing to visit you because you asked me to do so, and maybe we can do some more stories." And I continued to interview him for other publications. And along the way, I knew full well there was no book for a journalist or a student or a fan to go to read his amazing life story. This man did so much in his time on this earth. And so I asked him, I said, "Why is there no book on you?" And he said, I've never wanted to go there because I look at biography as sort of the end of the life. And he said, "Why don't you call me in 30 or 35 years and we'll get working on it." But I saw an opportunity there that he liked my company. He knew I was curious. He knew I had the passion for his contributions to culture. And so, again, that took about a year before he, at lunch one day, he said, "I've given some great thought to this, and I'd like you to pen this biography." And that's what started this adventure off.
So, Sam, Bradbury grew up, he was born in Waukegan, Illinois, and lived there full time for only a few years, but the place seemed to have a really lasting imprint on him.
That's very true. I mean, he has returned to the Midwest, and particularly Waukegan, which is in northern Illinois, not far from the Wisconsin border, situated right on Lake Michigan. And he returned to it over and over again in his writings. In many books, he rechristened it often Greentown, Illinois, a much more romantic moniker for this mythical town that he wrote about. But you're right. I mean, it was just so central to his imagination, and that's something I asked him about in that very first interview. It's like you moved away from the Midwest when you were 13 years old and never returned as a resident. Why is it that you have so often come back to the Midwest in your stories? And he said, it's going back to your own root system. He thinks that good creators so much of who you are is instilled in you at an early age, and that's why early childhood development, in his mind, was so vital and important. You instill your creativity and your ideas and your philosophies and your energies and your global outlook, and so much happens as a young boy. And I think, so he looked at this as an opportunity to go back to what he called his root system through the window of adulthood, and reflect on his own experiences and examine them from an adult's point of view.
It's interesting, too, because you, if you leave a place at that age, you can later see it from an adult's point of view, but you haven't lived there during that time when you develop sort of teenage and adolescent cynicism. And so it can become what you choose to allow it to become, as opposed to being colored by negative experiences.
Outstanding point. And I think Bradbury has been deemed critically as being somewhat sentimental and somewhat nostalgic, and I think some sort of literary snobs and purists sometimes think sentimentality and nostalgia are a very negative thing. But Bradbury was a hopeful man. I mean, even Fahrenheit 451, if I don't want to give the book away, as the city of Dallas is celebrating it, but I mean, it has an element of hope to it in its end. And so you're right. I mean, I think the fact that he left Waukegan before the age of cynicism had set in adolescence allowed him to kind of go back nostalgically to reflect upon it as this sort of beautiful, crystal clear memory for him. He also very much mythologized his own childhood, and I think romanticized it to a great degree over the years.
And then when the family moved to Los Angeles, Bradbury was ecstatic.
Oh, he was, you know, at sea, you know, at play in a sea of pure bliss. I mean, he the day the family arrived, Ray's father was out of work utility lineman for the local utility company in Illinois, and so they packed up and moved west where they had some family. And the very day that they had arrived in Los Angeles, he strapped on these old steel roller skates. It was April 1934, and his parents hadn't enrolled him in school, so it was a weekday, and he had no school to go to, and he roller skated 2 miles across Los Angeles and found himself outside the gates of Paramount Studios. And within a matter of minutes, this young boy, who was this ardent fan of cinema, that's something we could talk about, is how impactful cinema was on his sense of storytelling. But he wasn't out there but 10 or 15 minutes, and W.C. Fields walked out and encountered him. And Bradbury started, from that moment forward, collecting autographs and photographs with the greats of Hollywood during its golden era: Marlene Dietrich, Rita Hayworth, Fred McMurray, W.C. Fields, Judy Garland, and so many others. And collected. He had those autograph books by his side to his dying days. He carried them with him to the end of his life because those moments were so profound to him.
We have an email here from Steve who says, "When I read The Martian Chronicles many years ago, I was impressed with Bradbury's ability to populate my mind with such clear imagery. Do you think, Sam, that his love of cinema played into his ability to write visually?"
I really do. I mean, I argue, and I've argued this point over the years, that I think that Ray Bradbury could well be the first true literary writer. I don't just look at him as a genre writer. I look at him as a literary writer who wrote genre fiction. I mean, to me, he's on the same shelf as Dickens and Poe and Orwell and others. But I think he's the first writer of that stature who ascended to that pantheon of literature who was impacted heavily by the movies. His mother took him when he was 3 years old to see The Hunchback of Notre Dame, starring Lon Chaney, to a theater in downtown Waukegan, and he immediately identified with the sense of fantasy, the sense of sorrow in the character of the hunchback and the outcast character, and those are themes that carried through much of his work.
Sam Weller is with us. He's professor in the fiction department at Columbia College Chicago and author of the books The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, the Ray Bradbury Interviews. Of course, Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury is the book chosen for this month's Big Read Dallas Citywide Book Discussion. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sam Weller, professor in the fiction department at Columbia College Chicago and author of books including The Bradbury Chronicles and Listen to the Echoes. Both are about Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 is the book chosen for this month's Big Read Dallas citywide book initiative. Residents, including all DISD 9th and 10th graders, are being encouraged to read the book and discuss it. You can find more information about that online at bigreaddallas.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Dave in Fort Worth. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Well, we're talking about one of my biggest heroes. I'm 56 years old, and I was reading his short stories, R's for Rocket and all kinds of stuff like that, Bama books put out back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And Ray Bradbury shaped me as the man I was going to be. I aspire to be a writer. I have written. And he just didn't have the narcissism. He was just a good man writing good stories. Are you still there?
Yeah, I am. You're absolutely so right. You know, I spent so much time with the man that if he were sitting here right now listening to you say that, I know exactly how he would respond. I mean, he was a heavy set in his late years. He would chuckle heartily with his chest up and down, and he would hug you, and he would cry and thank you profusely for saying the words you just did. That would be very meaningful to him.
Hmm. Okay, so you mentioned earlier, Sam, that the money just wasn't there for him to go to college. Ultimately, he became an autodidact, and he had this reverence for libraries that is akin to what many people feel for their religious institution.
Well, you know, I've never heard it phrased like that, but you're so right. The library was his church. That's well put. He grew up going to the public library. As I said, he was part of a blue-collar family with very little means. And so the library was this refuge of education and imagination for him. He would go every Monday night with his brother Skip when he was a little boy and get books and go home and read them. And it was this free form of entertainment for a poor family. And so when he graduated from high school in 1938, again, there was no money to go off to college, and he did some sort of soul searching and thought, the only reason I really would go to college anyway is to meet beautiful girls and date them. And he thought, this is not necessarily the best investment of the money I don't have. And so he told himself, I am going to go to the public library three nights a week with no end in sight and read books every time he would go, and books outside of his comfort zone. He studied history and art history and the world's religions and political history, and of course he read great fiction, and he was very versed in the religions of the world. And so he went to the downtown Central Library in L.A. three nights a week for a decade, for 10 years. I mean, in so many ways he sort of earned a liberal arts education on his very own. And when he married his wife in September of 1947, Ray Bradbury was 27 years old, he realized that after a decade, he probably had earned a college degree and he had graduated from the library.
Hmm. And she actually worked full-time so that he could write full-time when they were first married.
She did. She was a remarkable woman. I think if you poke around on Ray Bradbury's own website, which is raybradbury.com, there's an essay I wrote when she passed away in 2003. And it really gives a behind-the-scenes look at Marguerite McClure, Ray Bradbury's wife of 56 years. She, as you said, she worked for a advertising agency, and she took the old streetcar from Venice for about an hour each way every day to work, supporting her husband with his wild writerly dreams. At this point, he was really, his career was just taking off. He had established his name in the pulp fiction magazines and was starting to write for the New Yorker and Harper's and Saturday Evening Post and those publications. But they weren't making a great living at that point. But she believed fully in him. And so she supported him every day and went to work and would come home and make dinner so he could stay home and and work on his stories. He often said that when he married her, he promised her that one day he'd take her to the moon and Mars, and in many ways he did.
The story of how he began to think of himself as potentially a writer is really interesting. He had, I guess, at a carnival, almost a mystical experience.
Wow, that, you know, that was probably his favorite story, and he'd be tickled that you're asking about that. It was the autumn of 1932. It was September, Labor Day weekend, as he recalled it. He was 12 years old, and this sort of threadbare carnival, this transient carnival had set up its tents along the shoreline of Lake Michigan. It was a sort of gauzy, gray, rainy day, and he went down and walked into a performance where there was a man named Mr. Electrico, and he had an electric chair, and he had this Excalibur sword, this massive sword, and he would sit in the electric chair, and an assistant would strap him in and pull a lever and charge him with all this voltaic energy. Mr. Electrico's teeth would chatter, and his eyes would glow, and his hair would stand on end. And then the assistant unshackled him from the chair, and Mr. Electrico stood up and grabbed the Excalibur sword and went out to the audience and started to tap the kids on the shoulders, the kids sitting in the front row, and they would feel the static charge coursing through the sword, and their hair on their arms and the back of their neck would rise. And he came to 12-year-old Ray Bradbury and tapped him on the left shoulder and then the right and then the tip of his nose and said, "Live forever." And Ray Bradbury thought, why did he say that to me? Why did he say that? And the story goes on, and I go into length about it in my book, The Bradbury Chronicles, and also in the interview book with him, Listen to the Echoes. But 2 weeks after that encounter, after that performer had said, "Live forever," Bradbury started to write short stories. And, you know, in so many ways, Mr. Electrico was this sort of catalyst to sparking his imagination, if you will, and getting him off into the discovering immortality through his creativity.
You know, I love that story, I think, Sam, because on the face of it, it's sort of ridiculous, right? You know, you go to this thing and there's like a carny and he's doing these things. And yet, really creative people, one never knows what the thing will be from which they make meaning that really lasts a lifetime.
You're so correct. You're so correct. You know, in my research, I've never been able to find Mr. Electrico, but I did find a permit for the carnival for that very day. I have found the actual carnival itself in the World Circus Museum, so I'm getting there. I mean, the trail is still, it's not quite cold, and one day I sort of hope to discover who this man was. But at the same time, there's a side of me that feels like, you know, don't give away the magician's secret. Don't expose the wizard behind the curtain. Leave it well enough alone.
How did Bradbury's career change after he had a book reviewed by Christopher Isherwood?
Oh, that was a huge moment in his life. He had written The Martian Chronicles. It came out in May of 1950. Bradbury was 30 and living in a tiny one-room apartment with his wife and his one-year-old baby. They didn't even have a telephone. He used the payphone across the street in a gas station and gave that number out as his office number and would leave his window open and tell radio producers. He wrote widely for radio back in the late 40s and would tell radio producers to call him in his office when, in fact, the office was a parking lot outside of a gas station. But Martian Chronicles had come out, and Bradbury would go into bookstores and make sure that the book was, if it wasn't properly displayed, he would properly display it himself, as many authors are known to do. He would go and dig the book out and stick it in the window or make sure it was prominently placed on a table. And one night when he was doing this, he saw Christopher Isherwood, the great, great writer and critic and just, you know, an amazing talent and force. And Bradbury rushed up to him and gave him a copy of The Martian Chronicles. Isherwood sort of received it very coldly. You know, he was always being hit up by other writers looking to have him review their books. And Bradbury said, "Mr. Isherwood, I'm a tremendous fan of yours. I'd like to give you my book." And Isherwood took it and thanked him and disappeared. And just a few days later, he wrote Bradbury a letter and he said, do you realize what you have done with the Martian Chronicles? You, sir, have written a beautiful book. This is going to be the first book I review in a new magazine that he was putting out called Tomorrow Magazine. This was a watershed moment, not only for Ray Bradbury, but for the genre of science fiction, because here you have a literary powerhouse like Christopher Isherwood reviewing a book of connected science fictional or fantasy short stories set on Mars, but reviewing it and addressing it like it's a work of classic literature. And it was really the first time that a piece of genre fiction like that had been accepted into the establishment of the literati. And it changed science fiction in many ways. And it was really the first time a book like that was addressed with seriousness.
So let's talk about Fahrenheit 451, because people may not realize it did not actually begin its life as a novel at all.
No, you're correct. I mean, he would tell you that it actually started off, to begin with a series of short stories that he wrote examining the destruction of art, the demise of libraries and library burnings, and censorship stories. There was one censorship story in the Martian Chronicles. And so he started with a series of short stories, and then that led up to, in 1950, he wrote a 25,000-word novella called The Fireman, very much the precursor to Fahrenheit 451. I mean, it had Guy Montag, the character who was in Fahrenheit 451. It had many of the same elements, but it was about half its length, and he wrote it. And no one would publish it because, of course, this was a time in the midst of, you know, the Red Scare and Joseph McCarthy, and he couldn't publish the story anywhere, and he ended up selling it to a pulp fiction magazine called Galaxy. He had to go back to the pulps, even though he had sort of elevated out of them and was writing for major magazines at that point. And he sold the magazine, the story to the magazine. It was published in February of 1951. And Ian Ballantyne, the great New York publisher, read it and saw instantly in it its potential as a elongated work to expand upon the themes that Bradbury had addressed. And so he wrote Bradbury and asked if he could add to it, you know, maybe double it in its length. And that letter from Ballantyne is what prompted Bradbury to go off and take The Fireman and turn it into Fahrenheit 451.
So for people who haven't picked up a copy of the novel in a while, the premise of Fahrenheit 451 is that Guy Montag, the fireman, he's not there to put out fires. He's there to, along with his colleagues, when books are discovered, which have been banned and are greatly disrespected even by those who wouldn't necessarily ban them, their job is to go set the books on fire.
Absolutely. They go house to house. I think much of that was an influence of Bradbury as a teenager watching newsreel footage of Hitler and Nazi book burnings and hearing about Stalin burning books and those things, these sort of fascist regimes and book burnings. And so these firemen in the novel go house to house to anybody who still continues to dare to read in this culture. Reading has been deemed to be a problem. I mean, it causes people to think. It causes people to dwell. It causes people, as it says in the book, to be melancholy. When you're too deep in thought, it causes you to have darker thoughts. And so why not do away with reading altogether and let's live a sort of escapist lifestyle and just fill our brains with sort of mindless, transient information that no longer challenges us and, as a result, no longer causes us to be troubled as a society. And so they've done away with books, but yet there are a few in this society, this culture, who dare to read, who dare to connect to the past where reading was celebrated. And so Montag goes into the house with other firemen to burn books and one day decides to take a book home with him to see why people are still so connected, why there are people willing to die for their libraries, why people are hiding their books to protect them. And so begins this sort of fugitive chase that is Fahrenheit 451.
And the story is so prescient. It's funny that Bradbury saw in 1950 what many people are still very worried about today, and the idea that most of the culture is, you know, spending all of its free time staring at these gigantic interactive television screens. Right? They have suspicion, and anyone who is too intellectual is sort of an outcast.
It's very true. I mean, he was as shocked as anyone at how he was able to predict so much, You know, he's 33 years old. Here's a man who has never drove a car in his life. He never owned a computer. He didn't fly on an airplane until he was 62. So, I mean, while he wasn't a technophobe or a Luddite, he did steer clear of technology to a great degree, yet he was able to predict so much of this, particularly the proliferation of mass media and television in the role of our culture and how people would rely on it in so many ways as an opiate. And so it was uncanny, and people would say, how did you predict these things? And he would say, I'm as shocked by it as you are. He didn't know how he did it. He just, you know, as good fantasists and science fiction writers do, they use their imaginations, and Bradbury just was able to look at the dawn of the age of television in particular and say, where might this go in the next 50 to 100 years?
Where was he when he typed out that book?
That, again, is a great story and returns to your what you have mentioned, to his church. He was living in a tract home in Los Angeles, in West Los Angeles, with his wife and two daughters. He was happily distracted by his toddler children. And Bradbury was this juxtaposition of sort of, when I knew him, as this 80-year-old incredible creative force fused with a 14-year-old boy. So he was always this sort of man-child and loved toys and was very excitable and very enthusiastic and had a great sense of humor. And so he was distracted by his children and wasn't writing the book that he was now under contract with Ballantyne to write, Fahrenheit 451. So he told his wife, I can't write at home. I'm too joyful out in the yard playing with our daughters. I need an office. And his wife said to him, well, there's no money, Ray, for an office. You need to find somewhere to write it. That's not going to cost us anything. And so Bradbury, not driving a car, hopped on his bicycle and drove to the campus of UCLA and found the Powell Library and walked in and went back to his old home, the library, to write Fahrenheit 451. He walked by a door that led down to a basement, and as he opened that door, he heard typing coming up the staircase, the sounds of old typewriters. And he went down and found students pecking away on those majestic old oily Underwood and Remington typewriters. He knew right then and there that he had found his office. So he sat down with college students all around him, and he started writing Fahrenheit 451. And he always loved to tell the story that the typewriters had timers on them. So he paid $9.80 in dimes to write Fahrenheit 451.
Sam Weller is with us. He's a professor in the fiction department at Columbia College Chicago and author of multiple books, including The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 is the focus of this month's Big Read Dallas project. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The book selected for this month's Big Read Dallas Citywide Book Project is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Because of that, we've invited Bradbury's biographer Sam Weller to speak with us today. He's the author of books including The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. If you want to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sam, why didn't Ray Bradbury want to learn to drive a car?
I have to preface by saying this is such a heady discussion. This stands in sharp contrast to the society that Bradbury depicted in Fahrenheit 451.
Well, I'm relieved to hear that.
This is awesome. He never drove a car because when he was 14 years old, living in Los Angeles, he witnessed a very tragic car accident. He rushed to the scene. A car had hit a telephone pole, going at terrific speeds, and Bradbury rushed up with a friend and the car had six occupants. Four of the passengers had died instantly, and the driver was a woman, and she looked up at this bespectacled stranger, this 14-year-old child, and her eyes fluttered, and she died. And the last thing she saw was this strange boy who grew up to become this great American writer. Bradbury was so traumatized by that memory, he walked home holding the wall of buildings just to prop himself up. When he got home, he realized that the accident had transpired outside of a cemetery of all strange places.
Hmm.
He wrote a great story about this experience called The Crowd, and it's in a wonderful collection of short stories called The October Country. But that set into his head a fear of automobiles. He was very much afraid of cars for most of his life, so he decided he would never drive. And that meant his wife was the family chauffeur. They had a station wagon and four daughters, and she carted everybody around. Bradbury would ride around L.A. on his bicycle or walk or take cabs, but he never once drove an automobile.
It's an interesting paradox for an individual who was so fearless in what he published and put out there and would try anything artistically, and yet this sense of his own physical mortality sort of never seemed to be entirely out of his mind.
You're right. He was a greatly paradoxical man on so many fronts, and that's something I really address in my first book on him. But you're correct, and I think, you know, he was, mortality was a predominant theme through much of his canon. And even Fahrenheit 451, it's the mortality of reading, and books and libraries. But he was, you know, he was, a mama's boy is what he would say. He had lost two siblings. A brother died during the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. His sister passed away when he was a young boy. She was only six, and she died of pneumonia. So he was a very sheltered child by his mother. And I think that sort of flinching from things in life, he carried it with him. As I said, he didn't fly in an airplane until he was 62 years old. He wrote a screenplay for Moby Dick, the film that was adapted by film director John Huston. It came out in 1956, and it starred Gregory Peck as Captain Ahab.
Sounds like a great job on the surface of it.
It sounds like a fantastic job, but it turned into a nightmare because Huston was this megalomaniac, and he was crazy and preyed on the naivete of this Midwestern boy and young man. But Bradbury, Huston said of Bradbury, he's this incredible contradiction. He sends people on fanciful trips to Mars, but he's afraid to get behind the wheel of a car.
Hmm. Well, he also told you, he said, look, I was never a womanizer, and then went on to talk to you very frankly about having multiple affairs, although he was very much in love with his wife.
Yeah, it's really a complex love story, I will tell you that. I mean, I spent a lot of time with the two of them, Ray Bradbury and his wife, and they married, as I said, in September of 1947. And from what he told me, and, you know, he was so candid with me, I have every reason not to believe what he said. He was faithful to her for 20 years. And the only reason he strayed from the marriage was that one day when they were in Rome, actually working on a script, his wife turned to him suddenly and very shocked Ray Bradbury in a big way, said, I'd like a divorce. He never understood why she wanted a divorce from him. I mean, I surmise that she grew very weary of raising four daughters and a husband who was also a child. She had to drive him around everywhere, and he was this man-child, as I said, and this Peter Pan. And on many levels, that was the wonder of him, and that's why he was able to write so many imaginative things. But being married to that would probably get very tiresome, and so she, I think, emotionally detached from him, and Bradbury, you know, up all the way through the late 1960s, said he stayed faithful, but opportunity knocked, and he strayed four times, all told, from what I can surmise in his marriage. He was very candid with his wife. She found out about these things. She stuck with him. They had this lovable relationship up until she passed away in 2003. She was fiercely defensive of him, loved her husband very much, but also knew full well that he had betrayed her at times. Their relationship was complex.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ray in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Ray Bradbury is one of my three favorites, and I would like to ask if he knows of any relationship, professional or otherwise, between he and Asimov or Heinlein, who are my other two in the triumvirate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray, very much. Great question. You know, there's considered to be the ABCs of science fiction, and those would be Asimov, Bradbury, and Clark. But certainly the other one is Robert Heinlein, who was Bradbury's mentor in the late 1930s. Bradbury joined a science fiction club when he was 18 and went to a cafeteria with a bunch of exuberant young writers with dreams, and one of them was Robert Heinlein, whose career was just starting to take root, and Heinlein took Bradbury in and really helped him, taught him, Bradbury would say, how to write about humanity, that good science fiction and good fantasy is not about magic and technology and so on. It's truly about compassion and humanity. That's what makes for good stories, and that's the lesson he got from Heinlein. Bradbury didn't learn a lot from Asimov, but knew Asimov very well, going back again to the late 1930s. The science fiction community was very tight-knit, and so they knew one another and corresponded. In an interesting sort of footnote, in 1992, Mikhail Gorbachev, the former leader of the former Soviet Union, came to Washington, and there was a state dinner in his honor, and they asked who he would like as a guest, and he requested Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury. So the two of them sat side by side with Gorbachev and Mrs. Gorbachev. So he did have a friendly relationship with Isaac Asimov, but they didn't influence one another much because Asimov hailed from a much more technological realm of science fiction, a much more hardware-centric sense of the genre. And Bradbury, of course, was always more worried about the human heart.
It's interesting to me when you mentioned Gorbachev that Bradbury, who early in his career was certainly identified with sort of leftist ideals, ultimately said it was Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II who were responsible for denuclearizing the world.
You're asking some really heady questions. This is very challenging. I think that there was this tectonic shift in his politics. I mean, when he wrote Fahrenheit 451, he was a left-wing liberal humanist, very far left. You know, he was investigated by the FBI. I declassified those files when I wrote my book, and they're looked at in the Bradbury Chronicles. And you know, there were thoughts that he may have been a communist. He was not a communist. He was just a far left-wing staunch Democrat. And but later in life, to the best of my investigations, sometime in the 80s, he voted for Jimmy Carter in 1956. But sometime during the Reagan administration, I think he really started to latch on to lower taxes and those kind of things, and became a huge and terrific fan of Ronald Reagan. I actually think it's partially because Bradbury's a movie buff and loved Reagan's back catalog. But yeah, there was a tectonic shift in his political leanings, and he looked at Reagan and Pope John Paul II as two of the greatest figures of the 20th century.
A couple of people have written in via email and asked about Bradbury's great disdain for Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11.
Sure, you know, some of these things I will discuss in my talk when I'm in Dallas. I have quite a few events around town, but I will be speaking at the Art Museum, and I will discuss that, but I'll briefly share with you. Of course, Michael Moore released this movie a few years back called Fahrenheit 9/11, and Bradbury was up in arms over it because he felt that it was, you know, it was a controversial topic, to say the least, that was addressed in that documentary. And Moore, of course, was using Bradbury's Fahrenheit title as in a sort of homage way. And so Bradbury asked Michael Moore to not use that title. He had heard that Michael Moore was making this film and called him, and Moore never returned Bradbury's phone call, which Ray Bradbury could be prickly, and he had an ego. And he was, you know, a great guy and one of the most generous people I will ever know, and certainly the most inspiring person I've ever met. But he did not do well when people didn't return his phone calls. And so Michael Moore sort of gave Bradbury the cold shoulder, and that really ticked Bradbury off. Bradbury proceeded to go on some cable television programs, do some print interviews criticizing Moore. And so the relationship started off very poorly. I was with Ray Bradbury one day when Moore called him finally and very sheepishly apologized and said, "I'm sorry you're hurt by me using this title. I love you like so many other people love you. I grew up with your books and you influenced me." So they made up. But Bradbury was never happy to have the title of his book associated with something that politically he really didn't agree with.
Can you talk a little bit about the discipline he applied? And you mentioned he was, in many ways, kind of a big man-child.
Yeah.
But, boy, he wrote every day, but not for as long as people might imagine, given his output.
Yeah, I mean, boy, up until the last few months of his life, he kept telling me, all you need to do is write 2 hours a day, but make those 2 hours count.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote some of his finest short stories, The Veldt, which is the first story in The Illustrated Man, and many other classic Bradbury short stories. He wrote first drafts of them in about 2 hours' time. He was a fast typist. He didn't believe in spending a lot of time intellectualizing the story, just let the story tell itself and intellectualize later in a rewrite. So he would only write a couple hours a day. I think early in his career he was more dedicated before he had a wife and children and other obligations. He would write all day long, but I think as time went on, he only wrote a few hours. He was a morning writer, would create, and then he would have most of his afternoon to himself to tend to other things. He was a prolific letter writer, and those letters have never been released, and I'd really love to find a way to get them out there. He wrote thousands and thousands of amazing letters to, you know, a cast of global luminaries that need to see the light of day.
Can you talk about, for people who maybe have just returned to Fahrenheit 451 or they've never read Bradbury before, after they read this book for the Big Read Dallas, where would you steer them next? And maybe based on what they took away from the book and what they loved about the book, maybe you have different recommendations.
I do. You know, I tend to sort of tailor my recommendations based on the interests of individual readers. And, you know, I'm a huge believer that all it takes is one great book to turn a sort of skeptical reader or a non-reader into a reader for life.
Mm.
But it needs to be a book that connects to their own interests. And so that's a tricky question, but the books that I tend to see work with teen readers, younger readers, reluctant readers, tend to be his short story collections. There's a book called The Stories of Ray Bradbury, and it's published by Everyman's Library. It has 100 stories in it, and those stories are remarkable, and they're simple. You sit down at night, and you can read one in 10 minutes and move on. And so I think that that's a great book to sort of grab you and show you the breadth and wonder of his imagination. There are stories set in Ireland, there are stories set on Mars, there are stories set in small-town America. It just shows you just how fearless this man was and the scope of his imagination.
Sam Weller is professor in the fiction department at Columbia College Chicago and author of The Bradbury Chronicles, The Life of Ray Bradbury, and Listen to the Echoes, The Ray Bradbury Interviews. The book for this month's Big Read Dallas citywide book discussion is Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. You can learn more about the project at bigreaddallas.org. Sam Weller, it's been a pleasure to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, download that podcast at kera.org/think. And any comments, questions, or suggestions can always be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.